Okay, good morning. So what I want to do today is to finish up this lecture on neural networks, and then maybe if we have time, we'll talk a little bit about decision trees. So last time we had focused on a three-layer network, which is often called a multi-layer perceptron, and we discussed the fact that with this three-layer network, with a suitable choice of nonlinear functions and weights, we could solve any kind of pattern recognition problem. So it was a totally general approach. Of course, we don't have an algorithm that tells us how to define or pick the best nonlinear processing elements, but we can usually find those by trial and error. So what we want to talk about today is what's called backpropagation, the process of training a network and re-estimating the weights from data. So any function, and for these first couple slides, I need to keep it in this mode because the images aren't rendering properly on the classroom machine. So any function from input to output can be implemented as a three-layer neural network. These results are of greater theoretical interest than practical interest since the construction of such a network requires nonlinear functions and the weight values, which are unknown. And we don't have an algorithm. There is no algorithm really to figure out what the best nonlinear function is. People typically just choose that and experiment with it on real data on their application. But the weight values, of course, we can re-estimate, and that's what we're going to discuss today, how you go about re-estimating the weight values. So our goal now is to set the interconnection weights based on the training patterns and the desired output. In a three-layer network, it's a straightforward matter to understand how the output and thus the error depend on the hidden to output layers. And then what we'll discuss today can be generalized to networks with more layers. But with three layers, it's kind of nice because you have the input layer, the middle, the one hidden layer, and then the output layer, so you can sort of manually trace through the calculations fairly easily. The power of backpropagation is that it enables us to compute an effective error for each hidden unit and thus derive a learning rule for the input to hidden weights. And this is known in some circles as the credit assignment problem. As you know, there's a lot of literature that sort of claims ownership of neural networks, and they all have their own little twist to how they describe these algorithms and such. But backpropagation is essentially a process very similar to what we've explored with hidden Markov models, where you know the input, you know the corresponding output for that input, you apply the input and the output to the network, and then you essentially try to let the network figure out what the best adjustments to the weights are to match that data. And then you just iterate and iterate until you reach some form of convergence. And that is a supervised learning paradigm that's very similar to what we use for hidden Markov models. So networks have two modes of operation. They have the feed-forward mode, or the what you might call recognition mode, where you present a pattern to the input units, and you pass the signal through the network in order to get the output units. So we talked last time about in recognition mode, you apply the input to the input layer, and then you sort of let the you do these iterative calculations. You calculate the outputs for the first layer, then you calculate the outputs for the second layer, then you calculate the outputs for the output layer, the third layer. So you sort of let the data propagate through the network. In learning mode, supervised learning consists of presenting an input pattern and modifying the network parameters, the weights, to reduce distances between the computed output and the desired output. And that's what we want to focus on today. Now, it's interesting to note that with a lot of these kinds of technologies, training algorithms emerged for neural networks long before the theory actually understood how to train these things in an optimal way. So in the mid-1980s, there were a lot of heuristic training algorithms, and people sort of knew how to train the network, but they didn't at that stage know how to connect it to concepts like EM and maximum likelihood and discriminative training and things like that. So this is a network that we're going to consider. We have the inputs along the bottom, X's. We have the weights will be called W's. So we have for the first, from the input to hidden layer, we have W sub J sub I. And then from the hidden layer to the output layer, we have W sub K sub J. The outputs of the top layer are going to be called V sub K's. And the target class assignments then will be called T's. So if all goes well, the T's will match the Z's and we'll get correct classification. We'll assume that we have some kind of nonlinear element that's differentiable, because as you'll see in a moment, to derive the iterative learning algorithm, we're going to need to differentiate this function. And typically, what people use here is something like a sigmoid distribution, which is a differentiable approximation to something like a sine function. Now, I should also mention that there are many forms of neural networks, and each of those general families of these networks has a slightly different way of training. As I mentioned last class, we're going to focus on the multi-layer perceptron here because it's a good example of what neural networks are capable of. But if you go in and take a neural networks, a course that focuses on neural networks, you learn about a lot of different types of networks and their corresponding training algorithms. So let's now talk about how to train or learn. Let's let T sub K be the kth target or desired output. So that's the answer, if you will. And Z sub K is going to be the kth computed output for K equals 1 to C. And W represents all the weights of the network. So the training error, much like we talked about the empirical risk, the training error is simply going to be what we observe to be the sum of the squares of the differences between the T sub K's and the Z sub K's. So if the network is working perfectly, T sub K's are equal to Z sub K's and the error is zero. If the network's working really badly, you have a large error. So we can think of that as simply the norm between the norm of the difference between a vector T and a vector Z. So the backpropagation learning rule is based on a gradient descent approach. And what that simply means is that the weights are initialized with pseudo-random values and are changed in a direction that will reduce the error. So we're going to try to modify the weights such that we reduce the error from the previous weights. And the way we're going to modify the weights, the direction in which we change the weights are going to be controlled by the direction in which the error is changing. Now, in the early days of both Hidden-Markov models and neural networks, people were excited because you could initialize these networks with random values and you could get pretty good performance. Of course, as these techniques became more mature, people developed ways to bootstrap the network so that you weren't simply initializing from a uninformed state. One of the big differences between neural networks and hidden Markov models, I would say in general, is that with hidden Markov models, you have a more refined model, you could say. It uses more knowledge about the domain. And therefore, it typically takes fewer iterations to get the model to converge to a reasonable state because you're essentially starting it from a more informed state. With neural networks, you have a simpler model, more general model, you could say. It's starting from a less informed state, and therefore, it takes longer to converge. It takes more iterations to converge. So one of the early drawbacks of neural networks was that the training times were excessive because you had to go through many iterations to get the weights to converge to a reasonable value. But you can control to some extent the speed at which the rates converge by this parameter eta, which is the learning rate. That's essentially just a proportional derivative control type parameter. If eta is large, you're going to make significant changes to the weights and so forth. So eta, the change in weights is going to be proportional to the derivative of the error with respect to W. And then the weights are updated using a simple first order difference equation where the new weights are equal to the old weights plus delta W. Now, of course, you're thinking, well, we could do better than this. We could use some kind of second order approximation here where we had a derivative squared. We could also do some kind of derivative, some kind of more sophisticated update weight equation here. And, of course, people do that. There are approaches where you actually update things based on second derivatives as well as first derivatives and things like that. And then people also do things like time adaptive learning rates, where you start off with a larger weight, and then you, as you get closer to the final answer, you make the weight smaller so that you can move in smaller steps towards your final solution. And all those kinds of games are possible to be played. The error on the hidden to output weights, this is the layer from the hidden weights to the output weights. The derivative of J with respect to those weights can be written as the derivative of J with respect to the network. This is the input to the units times the derivative of that with respect to W's. So it's just factoring this derivative into a product of two derivatives, one with respect to the net sub k function, and then one with respect, and then the derivative of the net sub k function with respect to the weights. And that we're going to write as minus delta sub k times the derivative of the net sub k with respect to W sub kj, and where delta sub k is what we call a sensitivity, and it's essentially how the error is sensitive to the net sub k. Now let me go back a couple slides and remind you where that net sub k came from. So if you remember, the net sub k is the sum of the W's times the Y's plus this WK0. And we wrote that as just W sub K times Y. And then the output of the units is actually the nonlinear function. So this is sort of the input to the nonlinearity. And then the Z is actually the output of the nonlinearity applied to that value. So the difference between the Z's and the nets is essentially the nonlinear function that you're trying to apply. So now we have the derivative of the, remember we need the derivative of the error with respect to the weights, and we have that in terms of this sensitivity delta sub k, and then a derivative of the net sub k function with respect to the weights. And since the net sub k's are a linear function of these W sub k's, we should be in pretty good shape with that derivative. So the deltas are a sensitivity of unit k, and it describes how the overall error changes with the activation of the unit's net. So the delta sub k's we can write as the derivative of j with respect to net sub k, and that in turn can be written as the derivative of J with respect to Z times the derivative of Z with respect to the net sub K. And the derivative, and this is why we need the nonlinear function to be differentiable, so that we can have a term for this. And the derivative of Z with respect to the net sub K, well, this is just the derivative of the nonlinear function, and this derivative of J with respect to Z sub K, since we had the error defined as the quadratic here, that just gives us t sub k minus v sub k. So we end up with a nice, simple expression for the sensitivity in terms of a difference between the expected pattern output, the expected output and the actual output times the derivative of the nonlinear function. Now, since net sub k we can write as W sub k transpose times y, and therefore the derivative of net sub k with respect to W sub kj is just going to be the jth output, the jth value of y. So this is a product of all the W's times the y's, but when you take the partial, you'll only be left with one of those terms corresponding to the jth node, and then when you differentiate that, you just get y sub j. So therefore, the weight updater learning rule for the hidden to output weights is simply that delta sub kj is just eta times delta sub k times y sub j, and that's just eta times, we can substitute for delta, the t sub k minus z sub k times the derivative of f times y sub j. So we can put all that together now and write that the error on the input, well, now, so now we can, so this is the weight update for the hidden to output layer, the top of the network, so to speak. And now we can talk about a similar quantity for the input to hidden layers. And that's just going to be the derivative of j with respect to w sub ji. And that, again, we can write as the derivative of j with respect to y times the partial of y with respect to the net sub j times the partial of the net sub j with respect to w, just using writing that as a product of partials. The first term, this w sub, the partial of j with respect to y sub j, well, that's just going to be the partial of our expression for j with respect to y. And that's just the sum of t sub k's minus z sub k's quantity squared. So when we differentiate that with respect to y, we can write that as, well, t's are constant because those are the input, those are the labels that we know for the data. So the only thing we have to worry about is the derivative of z. So we can write this as minus 2 times the sum. So the 1 half and the 2 cancel. And we just have minus the sum from k equals 1 to c of t sub k minus z sub k times the partial of this inner term. Well, the partial of this is 0, and we just have the partial of z sub k with respect to y. So that, in turn, we can write as minus the sum from k equals 1 to c of this t sub k minus z sub k. And now this partial of z with respect to y, we can write that as the partial of z with respect to net sub k times the partial of net sub k with respect to y. And that, in turn, we can write as, we'll carry over the sum, and then the partial of the partial of net sub k with respect to y is the derivative, is simply the derivative of the nonlinear function, and the partial of the partial of z with respect to net sub k is this f prime of net sub k. The partial of net sub k with respect to y, well, if you remember, the net sub k is just a dot product of w's times the y's. And if you take the partial of that with respect to one of those weights, w, you're just essentially left. With respect to one of those y's, you're just left with the w. So we have three terms here. We have a term related to the expected output compared to the actual output. We have a term related to the derivative of the nonlinear function. And then we have a term related directly to the weight. So we'll define the sensitivity for a hidden unit as delta sub j, which is just this f prime of net sub k times the sum of, from k equals 1 to c, of wkj times delta sub k, where delta sub k, and just rewriting this to make it look a little simpler. And this demonstrates that the sensitivity at a hidden unit is simply the sum of the individual sensitivities at the output units weighted by the hidden to output weights, and all multiplied by this F prime. So all that's really saying, you can see now how backpropagation is working. We worked on this term previously in terms of the output to hidden layer, and now the sensitivity for the hidden units is a sum, essentially, a weighted sum of the sensitivity of the output units. So we're kind of working our way down the network. So the learning rule for the input to hidden weights, which are we have two sets of weights. We have the input to hidden weights, and we have the hidden to output weights. And previously we had we derived the learning rule for the hidden to output weights. The learning rule for the input to hidden weights, delta sub j sub I, is just eta times x sub I times delta sub j, and that's just eta times this sum of w sub k, j k delta sub k, which came from here, times the derivative of net sub j times x sub I. So that gives us then what's called stochastic backpropagation, which is an algorithm where we simply kind of work our way backwards through the network. We apply the input to the network. We know the corresponding outputs that we should have for that network. And then we just apply our update equation for the output units. And then once we have for the weights representing the connections between the hidden layer and the output layer, and then once we have that, we apply the update equations for the input to hidden layer. Let me show you that. So we apply our first set of update equations here because we know we have labeled training data, so we know what the output should be. And then once we compute these W's, then we can go and update these W's because we know the inputs and we know we now have the weight for the upper layer. So that's essentially why they call this backpropagation. Because you're starting from the top and working your way backwards. It's actually, in some ways, you could say analogous to the forward-backward algorithm, where we kind of go simultaneously in both directions through the network. So you repeat this process. Now there is one sort of significant difference between the way we describe this iterative process and what we do with hidden Markov models. With neural networks, the tendency is to update the weights after each pattern is applied, rather than wait until all the patterns have been applied and then update the weights once, which is what we do with hidden Markov models. This is a much more iterative process where the network is constantly changing itself with each input pattern. You continue this iteration until your error rate gets below a certain preset threshold, or there are a number of stopping criteria. But generally speaking, with these kinds of iterative approaches with neural networks, you're going to go through probably in order of magnitude more iterations than you will go through with hidden Markov models to get kind of the same results, to get to the same level of convergence. So we can talk a little bit about stopping criteria. These generally build on some standard concepts from information theory. One example of a stopping algorithm is to terminate the algorithm when the change in criteria function is smaller than some preset value theta. Of course, when you with such algorithms, the challenge then is to find a value of theta that's relevant to your application, and sometimes these values can be application dependent, which is a problem. There are other stopping criteria that lead to better performance than this one. Most gradient descent approaches can be applied, so you can look at the amount that the error is changing from iteration to iteration. That's often a way that people get around application-dependent thresholds. You can also look at some information theory, theoretic type criteria, that sort of assess the overall state of the network. So far, we've considered the error on a single pattern, but we want to consider an error defined over the entirety of patterns in the training set. The total training error is the sum over the errors of n individual patterns, so we can actually generalize what the error function, which we talked about previously, which was just computed on one pattern. You can, of course, sum over all of your training patterns. And a weight update may reduce the error on a single pattern being presented, but it can increase the error on the full training set. However, given a large number of such individual updates, the total error decreases. So another thing that you'll observe with neural networks is that as you train them and you're updating parameters per pattern, you may see the performance of the network kind of fluctuate. It won't always get better with every pattern because you're changing the parameters only on a single pattern. You're not changing them to take into account all patterns. Whereas with the maximum likelihood training that we discussed for hidden Markov models, we would only update the parameters after all the training patterns were observed, and therefore you expect to see the error decrease with each iteration. So this, you'll get a global, if everything goes well, you'll get a global convergence, but on a per pattern basis, you're going to see the error fluctuate somewhat. Now, before training starts, the error on the training set, of course, is high, and through the learning process, the error becomes smaller. The error per pattern depends on the amount of training data and the expressive power, or what we call the capacity of the network in support vector machines. The average error on an independent test set is always higher than on the training set, and it can increase as well. So this is a curve that we saw with when we talked about support vector machines. It's a standard machine learning phenomenon that we know the iterative algorithm that we discussed for neural networks will allow you to get better as with the number of iterations that you perform. But we always have this balance between getting better on the training set and getting better on an unknown test set or some kind of cross-validation scenario where we take the training set and we chop it up into different test sets. The average error on an independent test set is always higher than on the training set, and it can decrease as well as increase because it simply depends on the degree to which the test set properties match the training set properties. So a validation set is used in order to decide when to stop training. We do not want to overfit the network and decrease the power of the classifier generalization. So what is really powerful about our neural network is that, in general, it will drive the error to zero on the training set. If everything is right and you're not getting stuck in local optimum and all that, you will drive the error rate to zero. And you allocate enough nodes and your nonlinear function is sufficiently general and all those things. But we, like support vector machines, we have the same problem that we don't really know when to stop training. You want to stop training at a point where performance on an unknown test set is minimum, but it's an unknown test set, so you never really know that, right? So what's typically done during training, much like what we do with really any machine learning algorithm now, is you carve off a piece of the training set, and you call that a development test set or a validation set. And you monitor the error as you're training. You do a few iterations of training, and then you evaluate on that test set, and you look at the error, and then you essentially stop training when you've reached a minimum on that test set, which is really part of the training set. And then you submit your system to formal evaluation where you're going to run on an unseen test set. Now, once you get the number on the, once you get the performance on that unseen test set, it's not fair to go back and retrain because you now are using knowledge of how you did on that unseen test set. But it's important when you're doing training to make sure that you push the network beyond the point where you achieve a minimum on your validation set. I see this a lot when students sometimes will present results. They'll give you this table and they'll say, well, here's various parameters of my model and here's performance. And you'll see, well, performance gets better and better and better, and then they'll stop at like 16, let's say. They'll go 2, 4, 6, 8, 16, and they'll stop at 16 when performance is minimum. Well, when performance is smallest. So they'll present this table. Now, when I see a table like that, the first thing I think of is, well, why didn't they push the number of parameters out to where the error rate started getting worse again? Because you really need to make sure that you're at a minimum. And the only way you know you're at a minimum is you push past that point and you see the error rate rise again. Now, what makes this difficult, so in theory, this is, you know, a good thing to observe, but what makes this difficult in practice is that often as you're varying the parameters of your model, you're increasing the number of parameters associated with your model, and you don't have enough training data to support that. So sometimes when people train these systems, they have to stop at a certain number of parameters because there just isn't enough training data to support larger parameters. And that makes it a little harder to determine whether you're at this kind of a minimum. You really need large amounts of training data to be able to decide when is the best point to stop training on these networks. And you should have enough data that you can observe the error rate get better and then actually start getting worse again. And again, I mean, in theory that sounds like an easy thing, but in practice there's a lot of experimental issues that get in the way of you actually observing these nice kind of minimums. So that's just something to think about. But one of the complaints early on about neural networks were that they overtrained. They're very hard. You know, you have to be very careful to prevent them from overtraining, overfitting the data. Now, it's also been my observation over the years that generally, so in the 1980s, in my field, speech recognition, we literally had neural networks people, and by the late 80s, early 90s, certainly, we had neural networks people competing against hidden Markov model people. And generally what I observed is that usually the hidden Markov model people were leading in performance because for whatever reasons, hidden Markov models were really good things to do for speech recognition research. But invariably, the neural network people could catch up, given sort of enough time and enough compute power. But they would tend to produce solutions that got the same performance as the hidden Markov model solution with fewer number of parameters. So one of the nice things about these neural network approaches are they do seem to give you fewer parameters in your system and actually can run faster because of that than comparable techniques like hidden Markov models and such, because the neural networks are kind of simultaneously optimizing all parameters, where the hidden Markov models are a much more constrained model. So, you know, the bit of wisdom here is that these neural network approaches often are very good at giving you good performance with small number of parameters. And in some applications, that's really important. So we've just sort of some summary points about what we've discussed. There's many forms of neural networks. So one of the things we didn't discuss, there's three important classes of neural networks to consider. One, use radial basis functions, much like we have with support vector machines. Another uses a Boltzmann's machine type architecture, which is an architecture based on a concept of simulated annealing. And this is an interesting approach because it's a network that for the same input pattern will actually produce different outputs. It's a random, it's a stochastic network. You will not get the same output every time you apply an input. Now, at first you might think that's bad, but you can actually use that to your advantage in some applications where you're really trying to understand or generate data similar to the input data. And one of the, and we've actually used these, an example of where we used these in my field, we did some research many years ago where we wanted to generate all possible pronunciations of a name. So we fed the spelling of the name into the Boltzmann's machine, and it would output different answers. And all that you were guaranteed is that the probability distribution of those answers matched what we had observed with manually transcribed pronunciations for names. But the network was actually sort of spontaneously producing outputs, each one which was different, and that was a good thing. So there's some applications like that where that property is useful, but for a lot of pattern recognition applications, that's maybe not such a good thing, because in pattern recognition, typically when you apply an input, you expect to get the same output every time. And then there's recurrent neural networks. These are very important for time series analysis because these networks, like hidden Markov models, actually take outputs and feed them back as inputs into the network. So when we talked about So we talked about how this is a feed-forward network, but there's nothing to say that you couldn't take these outputs and feed them back as inputs. Now, if you do that, you change the structure of the network. You change slightly the way you have to re-estimate. But that form of a neural network is called a recurrent neural network, and they were first introduced for time series analysis, and they're pretty critical to applications like audio or speech recognition, and a lot of work has been done over the years on that. It's still the same basic architecture. It's just able now to handle signals that come in a temporal sequence like a speech signal versus signals that just come to you as a static pattern classification problem. So the time recurrent networks allow you to do things like scan an input signal and only output a symbol when they think it's there. They can essentially do the segmentation and the recognition simultaneously, much like we can do with hidden Markov models. And now, and then another thing that, another advance that's been made, I would say in the last 10, 15 years is that the networks, a lot of the concepts of Bayesian analysis have been introduced into these networks. So the network, the neural networks that are developed today, instead of being based on the mean squared error, are actually based on posterior probabilities. And you can derive re-estimation equations very similar to what we have for hidden Markov models that allow you to train the network so that it maximizes posteriors and all that kind of thing. And in fact, a lot of the people working in neural networks have been at the forefront of Bayesian techniques. So some of the techniques we've talked about, for example, the relevance concepts that we talked about with relevance vector machines were first initially introduced in a neural network context. When we talked about soft margin classifiers with support vector machines, those were first introduced in neural network context. So you'll see a lot of state-of-the-art statistical concepts be handled from the neural network framework. And then there's alternative training strategies and learning rules depending on the types of applications that you're working on. It took a while, for example, to get neural networks to work well on speech signals, But eventually they developed all the little heuristic techniques that allowed the networks to converge and get good performance on speech data. And that led to the development of bootstrap training strategies and a variety of learning rules and things to deal with some practical issues associated with the speech signal. Okay, so let's switch gears a little bit now, take a breath, and what I wanted to do for the rest of today is to just introducing the concept of a decision tree. So we've now talked about support vector machines, we've talked about neural networks. What did these two techniques have in common? And that's why we're talking about them at this section of the course. Certainly they, and you could get good performance. So they're able to, so the thing that they share in common is the ability to approximate nonlinear decision surfaces using a somewhat data-driven approach, you could say. The support vector machines is a purely discriminative approach where you're directly modeling the decision boundary or the decision surface between the two classes. Neural networks actually are also a discriminative approach because we're training we're updating the weights with an algorithm that directly minimizes the error. Hidden Markov models, on the other hand, as we introduced them, especially when you talk about Gaussian mixtures, was a maximum likelihood or generative approach where we're trying to model the statistics of the training data with these Gaussians, and then classification is done after the fact. Now, a very powerful method for if your goal is simply to discriminate, to do essentially pattern recognition, to discriminate between different patterns, a very powerful way to do this emerged in the statistics literature many years ago, and it's actually a very simple concept that we can look at the data itself and we can organize the data into what's called a tree, hence the name decision tree. And by organizing the data into this tree, we can actually build a very powerful classifier that is totally data driven. So this technique, decision trees are very, very interesting because for a given data set, they can give you very high performance. But much like support vector machines, their complexity is going to grow with the complexity of your training data. So this is sort of at the extreme of data-driven approaches. If you give me a set of data, I can build a decision tree that will model that data perfectly, more or less. Whether that tree is general or not is another question. And what's neat about decision trees, there are two really interesting things. One is they're very simple to develop. You can use, for example, a binary tree where at every node you just have a yes-no choice. You ask a question and you sort the data to the left or to the right depending on the question. And then they're very fast because they're going to be a binary tree, you're going to have a log 2 type complexity in the amount of log 2 of the depth of the tree in the number of decisions that you're going to need to make to classify the data. What's also interesting about them is that you can do a lot of inference with them. You will actually, in the process of building this tree, come to understand a lot about your data. So, for example, this was a tree that was built to try to determine what the factors are people short or tall, sort of what the factors are in people being short or tall. And in the process of analyzing the data, the tree is able to learn some simple things like the gender of the person is going to be the single biggest attribute determining whether they're short or tall. And then you can actually look at height, for example, is another variable. So when you're done training the tree, in a somewhat similar to principal components analysis, the factors that most heavily influence your decision space are going to be sorted in a very nice way for you. So previous techniques we've considered have consisted of real-valued feature vectors or discrete-valued feature vectors and natural measures of distance, such as Euclidean distances. But consider a classification problem that involves what's called nominal data, data described by a list of attributes, such as categorizing people as short or tall using gender, height, age, ethnicity. So there's a lot of problems that fit into this category. In fact, I would almost argue there's more pattern recognition problems that fit into this category than into the categories we've been talking about in this course thus far. For example, we talked about, you know, the problem of car dealerships trying to sell you a car, and you fill out these little surveys. Those surveys are designed so that they can do this kind of analysis. So if you ever wonder, if you think about what you do on those surveys, they will ask you your gender, male or female. They will sometimes ask you your age, and they will group your age into maybe 10-year increments, you know, 10 to 20, 20 to 30, that kind of thing. But what they're collecting is essentially categorical data or nominal data. It's not inherently continuous valued. Now, how do you deal with such data in pattern recognition? Well, we have a problem that if the data is subjective, like what's your favorite color? How do you compute a distance if you like red and you like green and I like blue? How do we compute a distance in a way that we can differentiate and maximize and all these kinds of things we like to do with continued value functions? So decision trees is a very, very powerful way to deal with that kind of data, and we'll talk about this next class. And I think that these are a lot of fun, and you can actually build these very, very simple algorithms to build these, and they get very high performance. But they have trouble with generalization. Okay, we'll see you on Monday.